Listening to Cushy Radio.
Disappeared 7 hours ago. I'm doing this on Wednesday, so it's dated Wednesday, the 29th. It's on livescience.com, and I'm going to start to read it right now. Finding Planet 9 may require looking at telescope images in a different light. Astronomers are vetting a shifting and stacking technique that could aid the hunt for the putative world, which some researchers think lurks undiscovered in the far outer system way beyond Pluto's orbit. The strategy that would be difficult because I guess one of the things that the astronomical society or whatever it's called that demoted Pluto as a planet was this planet has to clear its orbit, so it's got to be a buoy in its orbit. So just like Earth or Jupiter, when it rotates around the sun, it clears all the debris in its orbit. So that would have to, maybe that would help people find, astronomers find this Planet 9. In, let's say, Pluto and the other, there's lots of bodies out there. They don't clear their orbit. There's lots of them out there, so this would have to clear its orbit. The strategy involves shifting space telescope images along sets of possible orbital paths, then stacking the photos together to combine their light. The technique has already been used to discover some moons in our solar system, and it could potentially spot Planet 9, as shown as also known as Planet X, Giant Planet 5, or Planet Next, and other extremely far-flung objects, researchers say. So here is, there's a video, join the search for Planet 9, here's how. So if you want to look at that video, you go to livescience.com, and the article is called Astronomers Find New Way to Hunt the Elusive Planet 9. I'm not going to look at the video now, but I'm going to continue reading. So says PhD student at Yale University, Malena Rice, and quote, you really can't see them without using this kind of method. If Planet 9 is out there, it's going to be incredibly dim, end quote. I think astronomers would have an idea where this planet lurks, so it's got to be, they're saying, around Jupiter, Pluto, or out past Pluto, so I don't think it could be anywhere inside Neptune. So let's stay tuned, maybe they'll find it. Rice is a lead author of a new study that put the method into action. She and co-author Greg Lachlan, an astronomy professor at Yale, shifted and stacked images captured by NASA's Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, which hunts for alien worlds from Earth out. In a test, the researchers found the faint signals of three known trans-Neptunian objects, TNOs, small bodies that can circle the Sun beyond Neptune's orbit, in shifted and stacked test images. The scientists then conducted a blind search of two planet patches of sky, turning up 17 new TNO candidates. So I do remember many years ago, before TESS, when Hubble tried to envision Pluto, it couldn't. All it had was a blur. So if TESS can vision them, that's a great advancement in terms of seeing things that far out, because Pluto, we know, is very far out. Even if one of these candidates' object is real, it would help us understand the dynamics of the outer solar system, or so says Rice. It's compelling new information. The researchers are currently working to confirm the 17 TNO candidates using imagery captured by ground-based telescopes. TNOs are breadcrumbs that could lead to the way, to the way to Planet 9. Researchers have inferred the hypothetical worlds existent from the odd orbits of some TNOs, which they say are clustered in a way that strongly suggests sculpting by a big far-flung perturber. So just like I mentioned earlier, where Jupiter sculpted the solar system, this planet 9, if it was in the Kuiper Belt or a trans-Neptunian object, it would have been a bully. In its orbit, it would have sculpted out. So does that make it easier to find? The data indicate a planet 5 to 10 times more massive than Earth, orbiting the Sun hundreds of times farther away than our world does. So Pluto is an odd planet being that far out, because we have the gas giants, or the ice and gas giants. So what they're suggesting is this is a solid planet, just like Pluto is. Not everyone is on board with this interpretation, however. Some scientists think the TNO's odd clustering arises from the combined gravitational influence of their many minuscule neighbors, not a single big object. So it's true, there's, I'm not sure the exact number, but there could be hundreds of trans-Neptunian objects out there like Pluto. And I'm not up on the names of the other ones, but there are a lot of them. The new study has been accepted by the Planetary Science Journal. Rice presents the results October 27th at the annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society's Division for Planetary Scientists, which is being held virtually this year. Editor's note, this story was updated at 4:20 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time to clarify that Rice, not Laughlin, is the lead author of the study. So, I don't know what to say about this planet 9, because there is also a speculation that Earth has another moon somewhere out there that goes far out, really far out, and then it comes back in. So are these things true? I don't know. So that was the hunt for Planet 9. Now I'm going to read another article called NASA Finds Water on the Moon's Surface for the First Time. This article is two days ago, which means it's the today's 29th, so it would be on 27th, the Monday. So again, the article's name is NASA Finds Water on the Moon's Sunlit Surface for the First Time. There are also plentiful patches of secret ice in cold traps. So what I recall about the cold traps is the rim of craters where the sun never hits. It's very cold. It's one of the coldest places in the solar system. There's apparently water there. Probably frozen, not liquid, as it would be too cold for liquid water to exist. So here goes the article. So again, this is called NASA Finds Water on the Moon's Sunlit Surface for the First Time on livescience.com. For the first time ever, scientists have identified water on the moon's sunlit surface. They also found that water is more common on the moon than previously thought, with pockets of ice hiding in shadowy regions of eternal darkness, some as small as a penny, new studies reveal. Sorry, I'm checking my recorder because it's very, very dim. I haven't found the light that lights up the back screen of my recorder. Scientists have been finding signs of water on the moon since 2009, and in 2018, confirmed the presence of water ice on the lunar surface. Now researchers in two new studies have detected water at one of the largest crater formations on a sunlit surface on the moon, and also found that the lunar surface could be harboring plentiful patches of secret ice and cold traps, regions of permanently shadowed spots on the moon. So says Paul Hain, an assistant professor at the Laboratory of Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado, and quote, "You can imagine standing on the surface of the moon near one of its poles. You would see shadows all over the place. Many of these tiny shadows could be full of ice," end quote. Now there's a subtitle says Finding Water on the Moon. In one study, researchers led by Casey Honnebale, a NASA postdoctoral researcher at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, studied water on the moon using data from NASA's SOFIA Airborne Telescope. So SOFIA is the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. I believe it's on the piggyback of a plane, and then it flies around like that on the back of the plane doing its research. So it's different than other telescopes that are in space that are orbiting the Earth. Previous work identifying water on the moon was based on a spectral signature, two distinct barcodes that scientists use to identify materials, which is reflected as a function of wavelength. But that data doesn't distinguish between water and hydroxyl, the OH molecule bound to minerals on the lunar surface. Previous observations spotted a chemical signature that could denote water or hydroxyl, but with these new observations, researchers were able to spot the unique chemical signature of water. The scientists found water near Clavius Crater, one of the largest crater formations on the moon, and also at a low latitude position of Mars, Serenitatis. The researchers found that this water exists around 100 to 400 parts per million. The scientists suggest that this water is likely sandwiched between grains on the lunar surface, which protects it from the environment. Now here's another subtitle, Trapping Lunar Water. Oh, first here shows the diagram. Sophia, it's a flying observatory. It shows a plane, and Sophia's on this observatory. So I'm going to keep reading this section titled Trapping Lunar Water. In another study led by Hain, researchers used data from NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft, LRO, in orbit around the moon to study the distribution of cold traps where water could exist not just transiently but permanently. So the I best believe it's called the Artemis program. When they're going to go back to the moon within 4 years, that will be very exciting. The scientists found a wide variety of cold traps, including micro cold traps as small as 0.4 inches or 1 centimeter in diameter, and evidence that there could be hundreds or even thousands of times more of these micro cold traps than larger ones. They also found these permanent shadows at both poles. In fact, Haines' team found that a whopping 150,000 square miles or 40,000 square kilometers of the lunar surface could potentially hold water. That's more than twice the area scientists previously earmarked for water ice on the moon. The interesting nature of these cold traps is that they're not just cold, shadowy areas where water is more likely to congregate. They are so cold that water ice would be literally trapped there for incredible amounts of time. So says Hain, quote, "The temperatures are so low on cold traps that ice would behave like a rock. If water gets in there, it's not going anywhere for a billion years," end quote. So I do recall something about the different qualities of ice. I think there's five qualities of ice, and in our outer solar system especially, and now on the moon in these cold traps, the ice is so hard, it's like rock. So there's different varieties of ice, as I said, five of them. Well, Hain and his team stated they need to actually find this ice within rovers or crewed missions to fully verify its existence. This new finding could prove monumental in humanity's plans to not only return astronauts to the moon. NASA hopes to do this by 2024 with its Artemis program, but also to create long-term human encampments on the lunar surface as a proving ground and jumping-off point to Mars. So that is interesting. If you get this brand of water that is so hard that it's like rock, how do you use it? How is it used in terms of being useful? How do they process it? How do they? So if humans were to live on the moon, there would be water there, but it'd be very cold. If we're right, oh, sorry, so says Haines, if we're right, this water is going to be more accessible for drinking, for rocket fuel, everything that NASA needs water for. Astronauts may not need to go into these deep, dark shadows. They could walk around and find one cold trap that's a meter wide, and that might just be likely to harbor ice. Okay, so Hannibal's work was published October 26 in the journal Astronomy. Haines' work was also published today in the same journey. So there's something I hear when I hear about when I read articles about the moon and how much lost time there was in terms of not continuing with the Apollo programs to the moon, and imagine what kind of discoveries could have been had if that Apollo program was continued. So this was called NASA Finds Water on the Moon's Sunless Surface for the First Time. It was published on the 27th on livescience.com. So what I'm going to do now, I am going to go for a break, and when I come back, we're going to talk more astronomy. So as I said before, I was very interested in terms of life on life in the universe, if it does exist. And on BBC Earth, there was another program about an astrobiologist saying what he's looking for is not life as we know it, but life number two, life that's very different than our life. So I have been very interested about this because of BBC Earth, so it's highly recommended you get BBC Earth. So this is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk. I will go for a break now. We'll have a couple of pauses, or sorry, a couple of commercials, a couple of ads, and when I come back, we'll talk more astronomy.
Accessibility,
disability,
mental health,
ADHD and ADD,
and many, many more topics we explore and cover.
But where?
On CITR's All Access Pass.
A unique and collectively run show on equity, inclusion, and creating awareness for people of all abilities in BC and around the world.
Catch us every other Wednesday afternoon from 3 to 4. If you want more info or want to get involved, please find us on Facebook or send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Are you interested in human rights and social justice? Come check out Amnesty International UBC. We fight to stop human rights violations all over the world, including here in Canada. Our club hosts letter writing sessions, social events, documentary nights, bar fundraisers, and current events discussions on a bi-weekly basis. So keep your ears open and check out our Amnesty International UBC Facebook page for more information. We look forward to promoting human rights with you.
In celebration of Black History Month, the African Descent Society will be holding a forum on February 20th from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at East Hastings Ray Cam Community Center. The forum will feature panel discussions and presentations by professors, MLAs, UN workers, and other experts who will be discussing a variety of topics, including racial discrimination, immigration and refugees, and a special honoring of the historical Black community of Hogan's Alley. There will also be music, drum circles, food, crafts, poetry, storytelling, and a heritage walk tour. So come and join this forum on February 20th.
Come and feel our positive energy at Falun Dafa Fellowship. Falun Dafa, also called Falun Gong, is an ancient spiritual discipline based on the principles of truthfulness, compassion, and tolerance. It's a self-cultivation practice that improves mental and physical wellness through meditation and simple exercises. It's been well documented to improve mind and body, relieve stress and anxiety, increase energy and vitality, and promote morality and spirituality. Why not give yourself a chance to learn free of charge? To learn more, please visit our website at falundafafellowship.com.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're back to in AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. So there's one article that I was interested in, and I would focus on things like gamma ray bursts, black holes, dark matter, stuff like that. And here's one of these articles. It's on livescience.com, and it's titled The First Star in Our Galaxy Caught Sending Out Fast Radio Bursts is doing it again. So there's gamma ray bursts and fast radio bursts. So gamma ray bursts are bursts of gamma rays, of course, and fast radio bursts are FSRs. So I will read this article. It'll tell us what a fast radio burst is. And what I thought was, in a lot of these things that astronomers are viewing, and for example, if they're going to view maybe a gamma ray burst, they'd have to look far back into time to find it. So at an age of our universe that was billions of years ago. So it's the fast radio burst. It would be difficult, or a gamma ray burst, to see in our own galaxy, or that's what I thought. So I'll read this on, and then I will comment on it later. There's one more story I'm just going to tell you, and it slipped my mind. So when it comes back, I'll talk about it. I think it's about life on Earth or life on other planets, and the search for life in the universe, which NASA is focusing on, and some have said it's NASA's holy grail. So again, this is on livescience.com. The first star in our galaxy caught sending out fast radio bursts is doing it again, 5 days ago, which means it was October 24th. So here's an image of a some kind of star with magnetic rings around it sending out bursts. A little dead star that dazzled us early this year is not done with its shenanigans. Magnetar SGR 1935 plus 2154. So a magnetar is a star that went black hole and then it collapsed into a neutron star. But there's, I believe it's about 7% of neutron stars are magnetars, which means they're very, very extremely powerful magnetic objects, the most magnetic objects in our universe. Magnetar SGR 1935 plus 2154, which in April emitted the first known fast radio burst from inside the Milky Way, has flared it once more. On October 8, 2020, that CHIME/FBR collaboration detected SGR 1935 plus 2154 emitting 3 millisecond radio bursts in 3 seconds. Following up on the CHIME FRB detection, the Fast Radio Telescope found something else, a pulse radio emission consistent with the magnetar's spin period. It's really, oh, sorry. So says astronomer Deborah Good of the University of British Columbia, and here in Canada, yay, a member of the CHIME FBR team. Quote, it's really exciting to see SGR 1935 plus 2154 back again. And I'm optimistic that we study these bursts more carefully, that as we study these bursts more carefully, it will help us better understand the potential relationship between magnetars and fast radio bursts, end quote. So she might be a student of Dr. Ingrid Stairs, who I interviewed many years ago about the about there was a certain neutron star she was studying that would sometimes or I think it was a pair of neutron stars going around each other, and the way they warped space influenced how each other rotated, because they'd go on these warp space-time curves, and that's how they travel. Before April this year, fast radio bursts, or FRBs, had only ever been detected coming from outside the galaxy, usually from sources millions of light years away. The first one was discovered in 2007, and ever since, astronomers have been trying to figure out what causes them. As the name implied, fast radio bursts are bursts of, or FRBs are bursts of extremely powerful radio waves detected in the sky, some discharging more energy than hundreds of millions of suns. They last mere milliseconds. Because most fast radio burst sources seem to flare once and haven't been detected repeating, they're extremely unpredictable. In addition, the ones we've detected usually come from so far away our telescopes are unable to pick out individual stars. Both of these characteristics make fast radio bursts challenging to track. down either to an exact source galaxy or a known cause. But SGR 1935 plus 2154 is only around 30,000 light years away. On April 28, 2020, it spat out a powerful millisecond duration burst, which has since been named FRB 200428, in keeping with fast radio burst naming conventions. Once the power of the signal was corrected for distance, FRB 200428 was found to be not quite as powerful as extragalactic fast radio bursts, but everything else about them fit the profile. So says astronomer Srinivas Kulkarni of Caltech. Quote, if the same signal came from a nearby galaxy, like one of the nearly typical FRB galaxies, it would look like a fast radio burst to us. Something like this has never been seen before, end quote. We don't know much about the three new bursts yet, but scientists are still working on the data. It's possible that some early conclusions are likely to change. But we can already tell they are both like and unlike FRB 200428. They are a little less powerful again, but they are still incredibly strong and all just milliseconds long. So says Good again, and quote, although less bright than the detection earlier this year, these are still very bright bursts, which we'd see if they were extragalactic, end quote. Oh no, keep on quoting, sorry. One of the most interesting aspects of this detection is that our three bursts seem to have occurred within one rotation period. The magnetar is known to rotate once every 3.24 seconds, but our first and second bursts were separated by 0.954 seconds, and the second and third were separated by 0.949 seconds. That's a bit unusual, and I think it's something we'll be looking further into, end quote. That could reveal something new and useful about magnetar behavior, because let's face it, they are pretty weird. Magnetars, of which we only have confirmed 24 to date, I didn't know that, are a type of neutron star. That's the collapsed core of a dead star, not mass enough to turn into a black hole. Neutron stars are small and dense, about 20 kilometers or 12 miles in diameter, with a maximum mass of about two suns. But magnetars add something else to the mix, a shockingly powerful magnetic field. So I may have gone into before what scientists believe could be the reason that a magnetar forms instead of a neutron star. So again, I thought it was about 7% amount of neutron stars are magnetars. So we don't know much about the new burst yet because scientists are still working on the data. It's possible some early conclusions are likely to change, but we can already tell that they are both like and unlike FRB. I read that before. Sorry, I lost my space because I accidentally hit the mouse and I went way up to the top of the page again. Magnetars, of which we have confirmed only 24 to date, are a type of neutron star. That's the collapsed core of a dead star, not massive enough to turn into a black hole. Neutron stars are small and dense, about 12 miles in diameter, with a maximum mass of about two suns. But magnetars add something else to the mix, a shockingly powerful magnetic field. These jaw-dropping fields are about a quadrillion times more powerful than Earth's magnetic field, and 1,000 times more powerful than that of a normal neutron star. And we still don't fully understand how they got that way. But we do know that magnetars undergo periods of activity as gravity tries to keep the star together, an inward force, the magnetic field pulling outward is so powerful it distorts the star's shape. I didn't know that. This leads to the ongoing tension, which occasionally produces gargantuan starquakes and giant magnetar flares. So I did hear about starquakes before. I think I did this about 5 years ago. SRG 1935 plus 2154 has been undergoing such activity, suggesting a link between magnetar tantrums and at least some FRBs. Obviously, astronomers have found the source of the first intergalactic FRB to be of intense interest. When CHIME FRB reported their detection, other astronomers went to have a look at the star, including a team led by Chu Weiwei of the National Astronomical Society of China, who had access to FAST, F-A-S-T, the large single aperture radio telescope in the world. So just want to make a comment. It's not astronomy, but when I taught engineering in Shanghai, one of our Chinese teachers, her name was Weiwei, Li Weiwei, and she was a wonderful young lady. And they found something interesting also reported in the Astronomer's Telegram, pulse radio emissions. These radio pulses were nowhere near as strong as the burst, but they're extremely rare. If validated, SRG 1935 plus 2154 will only be the sixth magnetar with pulse radio emission, and the pulse period was found to be 3.24781 seconds, almost exactly the star's spin period. So again, this is exciting because it's in our galaxy close by. So the spin period of 3.24781 seconds, the pulse period of 3.24781 seconds, which is almost exactly the star's spin period, is curious because so far astronomers have struggled to find a link between magnetars and radio pulsars. Pulsars are another type of neutron star. They have a normal magnetic field, but they also pulse in radio waves as they spin, and astronomers have long tried to figure out how the two types of stars are related. So let's read this again. Astronomers have struggled to find a link between magnetars and radio pulsars. Pulsars are another type of neutron star. They have a more normal magnetic field, but they pulse in radio waves as they spin, and astronomers have long tried to figure out how the two types of stars are related. Earlier this year, Australian astronomers identified a magnetar that was behaving like a radio pulsar, a possible missing link between the two, and evidence that at least some magnetars could evolve in the pulsars. SRG 1935 plus 2154 could be another piece of the puzzle. So says Weiwei, and quote, based on these results and increasing bursting activity, we speculate that the magnetar may be in the process of turning into an active radio pulsar, end quote. Give me a second. Okay, I'm back. So this was the type of stuff that I would only focus on before, something like this. Pulsars, magnetars, black holes, gamma ray bursts. I love that kind of stuff. But now, as I said, I am getting more into life sciences in terms of finding life. So here's another article on livescience.com. I wish I could read this. It says, Sue the T-Rex had a terribly painful infection when she died. Now that would be very interesting to read. Like, all science is interesting. So I'm going to go to the next article, which is about asteroid Bennu. So right now, I saw a show on the Knowledge Network, and I think there is excitement now because Bennu, or on the OSIRIS-REx mission, the spacecraft is at Bennu, and it's taking samples right now. So it'll return the sample back to Earth. And one thing I did learn about this was, I believe it's called Hayabashi. There have been two Japanese missions to asteroid, and one of them, I think, already returned a sample to Earth. So I will read more about Hayabashi next time. So this article is called Asteroid Bennu, Successful Touchdown, but Sample Return Mission Has Only Just Begun. This was 6 days ago, which was October 23. So again, the article is called Asteroid Bennu, Successful Touchdown, but Sample Return Mission Has Only Just Begun. This was 6 days ago on livescience.com. So there's an artist concept of the asteroid of the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft collecting material from Bennu. Relief showed clearly on the faces of the team of NASA scientists and engineers as they were told touchdown is complete. Then applause a few seconds later for back away burn complete. The most hazardous part of the mission was over and seemingly successful, although we will have to wait for a few more days to hear the scale of the success. OSIRIS-REx, which is short for Origins Spectral Interpretation, Resource Identification Security Regolith Explorer was launched in September 2016, arriving at its target asteroid 101955 Bennu in December 2018. The purpose of the mission was to characterize the asteroid, then bring some of it back for study on Earth. And on the program I watched on Knowledge Network, it showed pictures of Bennu, and I guess the scientists could be so excited about this picture and everything, but it's just basically rocks, dry rocks. They could have found water on Bennu as well. The spacecraft spent 2 years circling Bennu, making detailed maps of its surface, learning as much as possible about the asteroid's surface before the next phase of the mission, looking for somewhere safe to land, or rather, not to land, but to make a very rapid touch and go, I think they call it TAG, visit to the surface, where it would collect fragments of material to return to Earth. So I guess what it does is it sticks out its arm, touches the surface, blows out a nitrogen gas, and hopefully the regolith, the surface of the asteroid, will blow out and settle in the container. Why Bennu, and why the relief? After all, this is not the first asteroid that a spacecraft has visited, and it's not the first small body that has been landed on. That record is held by the near spacecraft that merited a controlled crash landing on asteroid 433 Eros in 2001. And I still remember the motion in the control room when Philae landed on comet 67 Churyumov-Gerasimenko in 2014. The relief was because Bennu is small, only about 500 meters across, a fact that was known when it was selected as a target, but is oddly shaped and active, two things that were not known. It looks a bit like an old-fashioned spinning top, or a rough diamond, pointed at the top and bottom and fatter in the middle. Because it was so small, it was assumed that Bennu would be quiescent. It wouldn't, for instance, be behaving like a comet and ejecting bursts of gas and rocks. So I believe I'm just going to interject here a bit about the Hayabashi mission, where the Hayabashi mission, it was a strange shape of the comet, or sorry, the asteroid that landed on, because it looked like kind of like a snowman, where one bigger lobe and then a smaller lobe stuck together. So they believe that two asteroids collided and stuck together. So it does look like a snowman. But because nothing in the solar system is simple, when OSIRIS-REx got close to Bennu, it found that the asteroid was throwing small amounts of material from its surface. The particles were less than a centimeter across, and most of them landed back on the asteroid, generally closer to the equator than the poles, which has changed its shape over time. One of the consequences of the activity, explained by changes in temperature fracturing large boulders and breaking up rock, is that the surface of Bennu is completely covered in rubble, much more than had been expected. This made selecting a site for sample collection more difficult. Now here's another subtitle called Secrets of the Solar System. Bennu is a near-Earth asteroid. I like that. NEA. So Trans-Neptunian object is TNO. This is an NEA, near-Earth asteroid. It has 1 in 2007 chance of colliding with Earth in about 170 years' time. Sorry, that's 1 in 2,700 chance. It's also believed to be rich in the type of organic compounds that might have seeded the Earth to enable life to arrive. Another surprising find that came from the mapping campaign was that Bennu was not only rich in clay materials, but that veins of carbonate were present. That's what I recall. On asteroids, there's carbonates and there's silicates. So I guess we can guess what those are. Clay and carbonates require water, lots of it, so these minerals must have formed when Bennu was part of a larger asteroid. Interesting. There's no running water there now, but there might be small pockets of ice below the surface. While this ice will not be collected by OSIRIS-REx, the effect of water should be seen in the materials gathered. Studying these materials will help us understand, there's another thing that came up, I almost clicked it, and if I did, I would have been sent somewhere else, so I'm glad I didn't. Studying these materials will help us understand the primitive dust from which the solar system grew. and the range of organic compounds present. It will also tell us the physical properties of something that might hit the Earth, potentially helping us stop it. It was always going to be tricky to collect material from the surface. Any attempt to land would be unlikely to succeed, because the low gravitational pull of Bennu would not grab onto a lander and hold it in place. A lander would bounce off back into space. This is why NASA used the touch-and-go method, or TAG, T-A-G. The spacecraft approached the asteroid very slowly, hovering around a meter or so from its surface, while an arm was extended to touch the surface to collect a sample. It did this by blowing a jet of nitrogen gas onto the surface, which was sufficiently powerful to throw material into the collection canister. The slow approach to the surface took several nail-biting hours, while the collection operation took a matter of seconds. Collection over, and the spacecraft back away. Hence the relief at mission control at the back away burn complete message showing that OSIRIS-REx was moving away from the surface. So I guess we got to give kudos to NASA again for doing such a complicated and a good job on this asteroid mission. We don't know yet how much material was blown into the canister, and we won't know until it arrives back on Earth in September 2023. So it's going to leave, I believe, soon, and it looks like it'll take 2.5 or 2 years or up to 3 years for it to get back to Earth. So I wonder why in some spacecraft, for example, it takes 6 or 7 years to go to just Jupiter or Saturn, but I guess this one is coming back, so it's faster, but I don't believe it took 6 or 7 years to get out to Bennu. So what's the difference in terms of the speed going out there and how fast things get out there? Because Bennu is apparently much farther than Neptune or Saturn or Jupiter. So we don't know much about the material that was blown into the canister, and we won't know until it arrives back on Earth in September 2023. It might be 60 grams, which is the target, or it might be as much as a kilogram. An attempt will be made later this week to see how the moment of inertia of the spacecraft, its uniform motion in a straight line, has changed, which should give a first approximation of the amount collected when the sample... Oh, I just wanted to mention when the... spacecraft comes past Earth in September 2023. Apparently, it'll drop its capsule and it'll drop onto Earth. And the spacecraft itself, I believe, is set for a mission around the Sun, which is really cool. When the sample comes back to Earth, it will be analyzed by an international team of scientists who will measure all aspects of the material's composition and structure, especially the organic and water contents of the soil. This is when we'll get some answer, which will tell us more about the origins, our own origins, as much as about the origin of the asteroid Bennu. This article is republished from The Conversation under Creative Commons license. And it says here you can read the original article. So the asteroid Bennu, it's a picture here. It says, image of Bennu taken by OSIRIS-REx in 2018. It's nothing spectacular. It's not round. It's kind of like an odd shape. It's roundish in a way, but it's quite dull, actually. But the scientists are actually so happy at their mission. So to them, it's definitely not dull. So this was called Asteroid Bennu, successful touchdown, but sample return mission has only just begun. So I am going to thank you for joining me today. There was some articles that, for example, here's one. Fireball meteorite that crashed in Michigan holds extraterrestrial organic compounds. Astronomers peer into the atmosphere of a rare exoplanet that shouldn't exist. And the Milky Way's quiet introverted monster won't spin. This supermassive black hole spin has been measured for the first time, and it's surprisingly low. So we talked about some things about life, some things about NASA missions, and I thank you for joining me. So I think next week, by next week, I will get my music, and then I should be able to put music on this. So thank you for joining me. This has been Marco. You have been listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Are you a graduate student?
De-stress from your studies through the Graduate Student Society. Come and meet new friends through our beer tasting sessions, sports leagues, and fitness classes. And maybe you're interested in making a difference. Help eliminate sexual assault by volunteering to become a GSS Active Bystander Trainer. If ever you experience difficulties with your supervisors, faculty, or the university, the GSS can provide confidential advocacy assistance. And we will work with you to help resolve academic, personal, or financial issues. Your graduate student experience matters. Let the GSS help you now. Visit gss.ubc.ca.
Not just rich people that own the media.
I own my 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 media.
The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members. Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
You're listening to CITR 101.9. Broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Gee, your station has a lot of problems.
Tell me about it. Just look at our morning guy.
Hello, this is Mole Man in the Morning. Good Mole Man to you. Today, part 4 of our series of the agonizing pain in which I live every day.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, not the home of Mole Man in the Morning.